This is What's at Risk on WBZ News Radio 1030 and WBZ.com with Mike Christian of Risk Strategies Company.
Hi, I'm Mike Christian, and welcome to a special encore presentation of What's at Risk. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind. Tonight on What's at Risk, we talk war and health. In our first segment, we visit with Evan Thomas, respected historian and author of The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire.
The Vanity Dreamin'.
Then, in our second segment, we revisit healthcare reform from the perspective of preventing chronic disease, the leading cause of healthcare costs in America today. Georgiana Donadio, Program Director for the National Institute of Whole Health, and Margaret Moore, CEO of Well Coaches, share their views on our healthcare system. On February 15, 1898, the USS Maine exploded in Havana Harbor. Although there was no evidence that the Spanish were responsible, newspapers such as William Randolph Hearst's The New York Journal whipped Americans into frenzy by claiming that Spain's secret infernal machine had destroyed the battleship. Soon after, blandly handsome and easily influenced President McKinley declared war, sending troops not only to Cuba, but also to the Philippines, Spain's sprawling colony on the other side of the world.
It's just a Cuban crime of passion, messy and old-fashioned. Yeah, that's what the papers did say. It's just a Cuban crime of passion, añejo and knife slashing. But that's what the people like to read about up in America. Up in America.
The War Lovers is best-selling historian Evan Thomas's story of six men at the center of this transforming event in American history. The rush to war at the turn of the 20th century that made the United States a global empire. The main characters are the two principal war lovers, Theodore Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge. The sensationalist newspaper man Hearst, the equivocating President McKinley, and the two antis, the thinker William James and the politician Thomas Reed.
Where did it go? Can't say that I know. Those times of revolution, of burning, 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 all so cool and gone. What was just was.
Though the destruction of the Maine was the catalyst, the hunger for war had begun years earlier. Depressed by the closing of the Western frontier and embracing theories of social Darwinism, this group of warmongers agitated loudly and incessantly that the United States should exert its influence across the seas. These hawks would transform American foreign policy, and when Teddy ascended to the presidency, commence with a devastating war without reason, concocted within the White House, a bloody conflict that would come at tremendous cost, and one with profound echoes even today.
It's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Indeed, as Thomas notes in his introduction, this is a book about Teddy Roosevelt and a distant war. But it is also a book about the run-up to the current war in Iraq, at times almost a sinister mirror, with its leaders who wanted to fight no matter the situation, concocted intelligence, a complicit media, thousands of deaths, and a quagmire not to be resolved for many years. It would be in this war that America would take its imperial ambitions across the oceans. It would be in this war that we would first face true guerrilla warfare. And it would be in this war that American soldiers would engage in such savage torture that some of their inventions, such as waterboarding, still haunt us today.
War in the East. War.
Evan Thomas is one of the most respected historians and journalists writing today. Two of his previous titles were New York Times bestsellers, Sea of Thunder and John Paul Jones. Evan Thomas was made editor-at-large of Newsweek in September 2006. He is the magazine's lead writer on major news events and the author of more than 100 cover stories. We're with Evan Thomas, the author of The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. So what was going on in Cuba in the late 1890s, and why was the U.S. so focused on it?
Well, Cuba was a colony of Spain, had been for 400 years, and it was revolting. And to some extent, we were focused on it to save the Cubans from Spain. There was a humanitarian purpose, but, and this is really what my book is about, it was more than that. There was this feeling in the country, articulated by some people that I write about, that they were ready for a war, that it would somehow help our national character to go to war. Teddy Roosevelt, one of my main characters, was the guy who, you know, he didn't make any bones about this. He said in a speech in 1897, all the great races have known the supreme triumphs of war, that war is greater than peace. That was an extreme version of it, but not uncommon. And when we did declare war on Spain, President McKinley asked for 125,000 volunteers and immediately got 1 million men.
Wow. So it was a pent-up demand, huh?
It was. I mean, it's hard to get your head around because, you know, why would you want to go to war? But war fevers do come now and again, and you know, sometimes they're, you know, war is completely necessary and noble, World War II, and certainly America's fought some wars that we had to fight. Some are wars of choice, and this was clearly one. We didn't have to go rescue Cuba. And you would think after the Civil War, America would be sick of war for a good long time, but a generation passed, and a new group of young men come along, and they want to test themselves. You know, this is old and not particularly American. It's just been true of peoples and societies all through time, young men who want to test themselves in the ultimate test of combat.
Yeah, and I've seen you term war a dangerous temptation, which I think is a great way of putting it. Was the country at that time just in need of sort of redefining itself, at least on a global basis?
Well, yes. I mean, it was a fascinating time. I mean, it's fun to write about because on the one hand, it's a very kind of flag-waving, the end of the Gilded Age, kind of a great booming time for America. But there was also a lot of fearfulness and uncertainty. This is going to sound kind of crazy, but the reigning ideology of the time was social Darwinism, this idea that the Anglo-Saxon race was superior. This was being taught, particularly at Harvard and at Yale. It was taught as science. But the problem was, if the Anglo-Saxons were such a great race, how come so many of them felt badly, that they were having headaches and stomach aches and lassitude? And it was known as neurasthenia. We call it neurotic today, but neurasthenia. And a lot of young men like Teddy Roosevelt were going west and trying to find themselves through physical excitement and exertion. And Roosevelt took the view that we had grown soft, that we'd become over-civilized, and that to overcome our weakness, we needed to recapture this conquering spirit that America had shown before. You know, we conquered the West, we got our independence from Great Britain, and Roosevelt wanted to bring that feeling back. And he had plenty of company. There were a lot of people writing about this at the time. The West was conquered by then. This is the 1890s, and famous speech in 1893 about how the frontier was closed, and we had to look for new frontiers. Well, where are you going to look? Look abroad. Go to sea. And his best friend, Henry Cabot Lodge, a very proper Bostonian, lived up on the top of Beacon Hill. He developed this ideology. He was really America's first imperialist, this idea that we should become a great maritime power and rival Great Britain and have a great navy. They didn't use the word imperialist because that was a European term. And in their defense, Americans have never been comfortable as colonists. I mean, we didn't want to go occupy countries and have colonies, but we did want to expand our reach, and we wanted to have a great navy, and we were wanted to become a global power, and this was really the first step to becoming a great global power.
Now, you talked about two of the three major war lovers in your book, Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge. What about William Randolph Hearst? What was his individual motive and ambition?
He's a totally fun character, especially for a journalist to write about, because he helped invent what we now take for granted as sensational press. I mean, in those days, they called it crime and underwear journalism, you know, sex and violence, and it sold newspapers as it does today. Hearst was a very colorful character. He had been kicked out of Harvard for painting the faces of his professors in the bottom of chamber pots and giving each one a chamber pot with their face on it. Harvard threw him out. And he was, he's a troublemaker character. He built the Harvard Lampoon, that little castle down there.
Right.
And he was fun, although dangerous at the same time. And when he went to war, he didn't, some publishers want to go to war. He went himself. He took with him to Cuba 20 correspondents, 12 yachts, a giant hot air balloon, a printing press. He brought a printing press to Cuba so he could publish his paper there, the first ever motion picture camera to be used. And he brought two showgirls dressed up in sailor suits. One was his girlfriend, Millicent. I mean, he was just a larger-than-life character, and he went to the battle. He was at San Juan Hill, or not far away, and 3 days later, he was on his yacht following the naval battle of Santiago, and he went, when a Spanish ship was sunk, he went ashore and took out his pistol and captured 29 Spanish sailors, made them give a cheer for Old Glory and George Washington, and then turned them over to the U.S. Navy and got a receipt for it. I mean, what kind of publisher does that today? But that was, that's the age I'm writing about. It was a very kind of larger-than-life time.
It seems to me that it's been intimated down through the years that Hearst had something to do with blowing up the warship Maine in the Havana Harbor. Is that, you think there's any truth to that?
No. He twisted the truth like a lot of these guys. The truth is the Maine, this is probably most high school students really all they remember about the Spanish-American War. The Maine blew up in Havana Harbor in 1898, and the cry went up, remember the Maine. And Hearst, among others, put out this idea that it was a Spanish torpedo, because they needed a provocation to go to war. Actually, it was an accident, but it was a fault of faulty design. The coal bunker on the battleship was placed too close to the powder magazine, and when there was a coal fire, it blew up the ship. We know that now, but at the time, the people who wanted to go to war made a big fuss that it was a Spanish plot. So he twisted the truth, but he didn't sink the Maine himself.
The war in 1898, I was 17 on May 1st. I read how the Spanish tortured Cubans according to Randolph Hearst. I joined T.R.'s Rough Riders. I was there at San Juan Hill when he led the charge on a chestnut horse like his idol, Buffalo Bill. Remember the Maine, somebody yelled as a bullet hit my knee. But I kept on riding anyway so that Cuba could be free. When the battles they were over, it was Uncle Sam that ruled. Teddy Roosevelt was no hero, Teddy Roosevelt was a fool. Dewey took the Philippines when he blocked Manila Bay. We even got Puerto Rico, New York City had a big parade. The peace treaty signed in Paris, Spain lost every colony. Even Frank James, Jesse's brother, he admired the robbery. The frontier fully settled now, big business in its greed. Set to save us from a Wall Street crash, it's an empire that we need. The Cubans, they got nothing. They were treated like dumb mules. Teddy Roosevelt was no hero. Teddy Roosevelt was a fool.
We're back with Evan Thomas, author of The War Lovers.
Now, Teddy Roosevelt was definitely a master of self-promotion. Were there any real heroics in the charge up San Juan Hill by Teddy?
Yes,
and that's
the point I want to make about Roosevelt. I mean, yes, he was kind of crazy about all this. His friends thought he was crazy and told him so, you know, because he's 39 years old. He's got a family of four kids. His wife has nearly died in childbirth that winter, and son's having a nervous breakdown, and yet he goes to war, and he's on his horse. He's out ahead of his troops going up that hill. He's nicked a couple of times by bullets. He gets to the top, charges down the other side, shouting out, "Holy Godfrey, what fun," as two of his men are shot beside him. On the next hill, he kills a Spaniard with his own hand, as he boasts about this in a letter to Henry Cabot Lodge. I mean, he was incredibly brave. And, you know, he was not a chicken hawk. He was not one of these old men who just sends young men off to die. He went himself, and he wrote his friends at the time, he felt that if he didn't go, after all he'd said about war and how great it was, he'd be a hypocrite. He'd be a blowhard, and he didn't want to be seen blustering and having empty words. So I give him credit for this. He went himself, and he exposed himself to, you know, mortal danger and survived and gloried in it. And the next thing you know, he was running for governor of New York, and then he was president of the United States.
Sounds like he was more borderline reckless than brave.
He was, but, you know, he's one of these characters about who's you can't believe what he's getting away with. It's almost as if the gods were watching him and despaired him, because he should have been killed going up that hill. But he got away with it, and I think he was actually a great president. I mean, I write about a darker side of Roosevelt in this book, but I think he belongs on Mount Rushmore, the progressive era, and all that was a good thing. So he's just this wonderful character. He's outrageous. He's way out there. But he accomplished a lot.
How did the war in Cuba lead to the invasion of the Philippines by the U.S.?
It was an accident. Roosevelt, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, had sent a fleet out there just in case they needed to fight the Spanish fleet, and they did in Manila Bay. But the next thing you know, after defeating the Spanish fleet, we're occupying the Philippines. Most Americans couldn't find the Philippines on a map, and we were not greeted as liberators when we arrived there. We were greeted as occupiers. So this very rough counterinsurgency broke out. You know, counterinsurgencies, as we are discovering in Iraq and Afghanistan, are tough because you don't know who the civilians are and who the soldiers are, and there were atrocities on both sides. And one little detail that caught my attention, we borrowed a torture from the Spaniards, who were a pretty rough bunch, called the water cure. Well, that's waterboarding, and we used it for the first time in 1899 in the Philippines.
Now, that's a somewhat forgotten conflict, but it did have far-reaching implications, right?
It did. Most people, I think, have totally forgotten it. But there we are in the Philippines. We became a target for Japan, of course, in 1941. Interestingly, Roosevelt foresaw this. Having initiated the events that took over the Philippines, in about 1908 or so, as president, he says, you know, we're going to fat target for Japan. He could see Japan as a rising naval power, and sure enough, in December 8th, I guess it was, 1941, the Japanese are bombing the Philippines, and General MacArthur and all that. We had to recapture them at great cost. The Filipinos today, I'm told, are not anti-American, even though they were essentially an American colony. We were a fairly benign, colonialists go, we were relatively benign, and eventually did give the Philippines their independence.
Now, you did have a sort of a countermanding character in this, William James, the noted Harvard professor and philosopher. He also played a role in the War of Lovers. What was his view of the war?
Well, I use him because he had a great sense of human nature. He was a pre-Freudian psychologist who had a real grasp, and he understood that young men are drawn to war. He understood the pull of war, the lure of war, the seduction of war. But he warned against it. He said we have to resist this. We shouldn't just go running off to war. So I use him as a kind of a Greek chorus in the book. He gave a wonderful speech up there on Beacon Hill, on the top of Beacon Hill, at the dedication of the Shaw Memorial. I'm sure a lot of your listeners saw the movie Glory about Robert Gould Shaw.
Yep.
And William James's own brother had been an adjutant to Shaw, and so he gave the speech at the dedication of the memorial in 1897. And he said, you know, we should praise Shaw's physical courage, but that's not unusual. A lot of soldiers have it. His real courage was his civic courage, his moral courage, and leaving his fancy troop of Harvard boys and going to run a group of a regiment of black soldiers who weren't respected and and putting making it common cause with those black soldiers. That's really what we should remember him for. I thought it was a great speech, and interestingly, the time did not get much attention because the country was so wound up for a fight they weren't really listening to that part of the speech. But it was a great speech, and so I used William James as a character, as I say, kind of a Greek chorus to come down stage left and talk about the temptation of war.
And did these two conflicts, Cuba and the Philippines, did it put the U.S. in a better place in the world order at that time?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, it certainly established that we were a coming world power. The rest of the world said, whoa, because we won these two naval battles that were, showed that we had a great navy, and it was the beginning of the special relationship with Great Britain. So I suppose you could say that we've kind of planted our flag and let the world know that we were coming. It had a cost, 4,000 men, and there's not a small cost. In the Philippines was where most of them died. And the country was ambivalent about it. We could have pulled back a little bit. It's not like this was the beginning of some great imperial age. We didn't go around conquering a lot of other countries. Americans have always been ambivalent about being, they don't like to be colonialists. And although, we go to war when we have to, there's always been mixed feelings about it. I think that those mixed feelings go on today. I mean, I think you can sense it in the country as we deal with Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, Evan, it's a great read, The War Lovers. Is there a place the listeners can find out more about it?
Sure. You can always go to Amazon.com. I have a website, evanthomasbooks.com. It should be in bookstores everywhere. And, it's a good read, and I hope people buy it.
Time for a CBS News update. We'll be right back with more What's at Risk.
When your company is considering risk management and consultative support for your business insurance, make the right choice and call Risk Strategies Company. With offices in Massachusetts, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Irvine, California, Chicago, and Providence, Risk Strategies Company takes a team approach to protecting your assets efficiently and cost-effectively. By offering a wide range of services and capabilities, Risk Strategies Company brings the highest level of expertise to clients in all areas of insurance and risk management, delivering insurance solutions, extensive carrier relationships and marketing expertise, claim advocacy, loss control safety management, health and welfare coverage, life and executive compensation plans, personal insurance lines, and surety. For the most comprehensive risk management and insurance coverage for your business, depend on Risk Strategies Company. Learn more at risk-strategies.com or call 617-330-5700. 617-330-5700.